It's Independence Day, and you're listening to the best of Morning Sedition with Mark and Mark. Hey, Fresno, welcome aboard. We're being heard on KFPT 790 AM, Fresno's Progressive Talk. And don't forget, we'll be back live tomorrow with Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. It's 6 past the hour, and you're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. I'm Mark Barron, that's Mark Riley, and broadcasting. We're broadcasting live from the Key Lounge in Park Slope, Brooklyn, at Union Street and 7th Avenue. Free coffee. Oh, my God, this is crazy. This is crazy. We're waiting for Lawton Smalls to drop by. Right now we're in the middle of a conversation with Nelson George, the author of Post-Soul Nation. We got books right here. We might give away a couple in a couple of minutes. Nelson George is also the producer of HBO's Everyday People, which showcases the effects of gentrification in one restaurant in downtown Brooklyn. His Brooklyn's own Nelson George. Still
there
here.
There you go.
We're getting into the discussion of Biggie Smalls, who reinvigorated the East Coast rap scene, was from Brooklyn.
Right.
And was...
Not very far from here, actually.
Oh, really? Yeah. Where is he from exactly from here?
Right across Fulton Street, by the A-train on Clinton, Washington.
Oh, was it Clinton, way? Washington or Cumberland? Somewhere.
Oh, that way, yeah.
Yeah.
I have no idea myself. We got... Exactly. A lot of different voices are saying different things, so we can. That makes perfect sense.
We sorted that.
Close.
So he was killed, gunned down 10 years ago. It's not clear who did it. There's a lot of speculation. Some people I've read say that Suge Knight had both of them killed, Tupac and Biggie. I've heard that there was two gang theories. There's a lot of theories. Which theory do you
Well, basically, believe? The Biggie-Tupac thing is the JFK for the hip-hop generation.
Okay.
They view it as conspiracy theories. Tupac's not dead.
Yeah.
There's a whole group of... He's in Mexico.
With Elvis and Jim Morrison?
Exactly.
Okay.
The truth is, it's very doubtful that Suge had anything to do with Tupac's death. He was in the car with him when he was shot. Someone sprayed the car with automatic weapon fire. It's just very unlikely that if you want to have someone killed, you'd be in the line of fire
with
them.
Right, yeah.
So, I mean, I think that goes out the window. And that's part, actually, of the Wallace lawsuit, civil suit.
The family of Biggie Smalls is basically going after the LAPD for a cover-up.
Right.
Okay.
And, there are things in it that are questionable. There's evidence in it that suggests there might have been something, but it's been 10 years. Unless someone comes forward and really just says, I did it, or I was involved in this conspiracy, it's going to be very hard to prove that right now.
And that happens so often.
Exactly.
But Nelson, I mean, we're talking about 10 years. We're talking about two icons of hip-hop who are both dead, and neither or none of their killers have been brought to justice. Do you ever think that'll happen? I mean, never mind the lawsuit. Do you think anyone will be charged and eventually locked up for it?
I mean, look what happened. How is it 40 years for this case down in Mississippi, the Civil Rights case? Unless someone comes forward or some evidence that's not, I mean, the FBI has already signed off and said they're not investigating anymore because they think the evidence trail is cold.
Are you sure they're not just afraid of Suge Knight?
That could be it.
I don't know. I think Suge Knight's become everyone's favorite gangster. He's like become the icon of gangsterism in this country.
Yeah.
I don't think he's at all powerful, quite honestly. So I think that
He said it. I just want to make sure that's clear to anyone who's listening in Los Angeles.
Uh-oh.
I think that eventually something will happen. But will both killers actually be absolutely found? I think it's doubtful right now. There's murders all over this country that happen every day that no one knows. They're never going to come to trial. This is going to be two of those.
But, I mean, was this a botched police investigation?
Absolutely. I think so. I mean, what they're positing is that there was an LAPD officer who commissioned someone to shoot. There's names. In the lawsuit, they named the officer. They named the shooter.
Yeah.
I mean, they're very specific. So they have some information, but is it information can take the court and prove?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Well, we'll have to keep our eye on that for the next eternity as to whether or not that justice will be served in that case. Post-Soul Nation, the explosive, contradictory, triumphant, and tragic 1980s as experienced by African Americans, previously known as blacks and before that Negroes, by Nelson George.
Like
it's a
title.
Big title.
Yeah,
big
exactly.
Title.
Long title. But you made that up?
It's my Tom Wolfe homage.
Oh, okay.
What's this book cover?
The cover says it all. You have Ronald Reagan shaking hands with Michael Jackson in the Rose Garden in 1984. That's the 80s, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So it's a book about the 80s from a sort of an African-American point of view. But Ronald Reagan plays a very big part of it since his His decisions, the neoconservative revolution, had a profound impact on what happened to black America.
What are some of the high points you talk about in the book?
High point. Well,
high low points.
The key word is contradictory.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Jackson, Oprah Winfrey, Bill Cosby, so many superstars. Jesse Jackson's run for president twice.
Yeah.
These were highlights. These were things that were never been accomplished by African Americans before. Same time, a huge, huge creation of what we call now the underclass.
Mm-hmm.
Crack devastated the black community. It took working class neighborhoods and made them really war zones.
Mm-hmm.
And you have the introduction of HIV and AIDS. And people forget, we tend to identify the early days of AIDS with the gays, but there was a lot of connections made. There was a whole thing about Haitians, and people forget, Haitians were initially seen as the purveyors of HIV in this country, which sounds ridiculous now.
Yes.
But in fact, the Center for Disease Control even said that at one point.
Yeah,
hemophiliacs, heroin addicts, homosexuals, and Haitians.
There's some Christian groups that think you can get AIDS by thinking about it.
I wish that was true for some of them.
Nice, Nelson. Very nice. You know, you've written a lot about popular music throughout your career.
Right.
Where are we at? I mean, is anything any good anymore?
Well, you know what? The music industry is in chaos and still trying to figure out how to market music. So what's happened is that we've gone back to the age of singles. The iPod, the downloading, we've changed from a structure of albums. The album is the definition of an artist, that the Beatles with Sgt. Pepper codified in 67. That's over.
Yeah,
it's about singles again. And so in a way, it's going back to the early days of rock and roll, which is why the record companies are upset, because albums, you make more money.
That's
right. Yeah. We've been talking to Nelson George. The book is Post Soul Nation. Can I say the title again?
Yeah.
The Explosive, Contradictory, Triumphant, and Tragic 1980s as Experienced by African Americans, previously known as Blacks, and before that, Negroes. Nelson George, thanks for being here. It was great talking.
Thanks.
Brooklyn!
We're going to be back with DMC from Run DMC, Daryl McDaniels. We're going to be back with Lawton Smalls at 13 past the hour. You're listening to Air America Radio's Morning Sedition live from Brooklyn.
Yeah.
You're listening to the best of Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour. Good morning. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
It's Morning Sedition. You're listening to Air America Radio, broadcasting live from the Key Lounge in Park Slope, Brooklyn, at Union Street and 7th Avenue. You can still come down. There's still a little room. Having a good time. If you want to, you know, figure out where exactly it is, you can go to keyloungeny.com. Coming up shortly, we've got rap pioneer Daryl McDaniels, a.k.a. DMC of Run DMC. We'll be here in a few minutes. Right now, I'd like to get into this. Since our president is openly operating in a different reality, we think it's important that that Americans know what's happening in this alternate universe. Luckily, we have a staffer who lives in that world. So now here again is Planet Bush Bureau Chief Lawton Smalls. Good morning, Lawton.
Yeah.
Is this your first time in Brooklyn?
Good morning, Mark. Yes, obviously it's my first time in Brooklyn.
Uh-huh.
You might as well ask if this is my first time in purgatory. My first time into the frying pan.
All right, okay.
Sizzling.
I get it. So how'd you get here, man?
I got here by the road to perdition.
Mm.
The F train.
No.
I have never been so terrified in my life. You people ride that thing every day? You know, that's how Satan travels.
Oh.
Underground and in the dark. In the dark.
All right. What happened, Martin? I mean, what are you worked up about?
Well, all right. You can imagine I was a little bit nervous on the platform down
sure.
there. I was smelly, full of strange people all around me. So when the train came, I couldn't decide whether to get on or not. So I just stood there holding the closing doors for like 5 or 6 minutes. People said such hateful things.
Wow.
I've never heard such anger.
Really? Imagine that. I wouldn't think that would have happened.
You know, then after I got on, I never saw such a bunch of sad, lost liberal freaks in all my life. You know, folks, you know, not making eye contact, no blinking. You know, they were like lizards out there in the sun.
Come on.
Angry-looking kids in ball caps with the brims that stick straight out. You know, straight out.
Come on.
What's that all about? Everybody listening to headphones, you know? I know what station they were listening to. W-H-E-L-L.
Hey.
Direct contact
come on.
From Beelzebub.
Well, so wait, so how do people get around on Planet Bush?
Oh, totally what? Different story. Uh-huh. I hop in my SUV,
pop in
a little Toby Keith.
Uh-huh.
I got brand new rims. Believe me, my ride is pimped.
Oh.
Okay?
Sounds so
king of the world.
When you say that.
Down here, you're scurrying around like a rat.
Oh, come on.
I saw plenty of rats down here, by the way. Enormous. Oh. Thought they were going to eat me. Is
come
that
on.
Okay?
Come
folks
on.
Folks living
dude,
with rats.
Dude,
is that Lawton, all right?
Lawton, it isn't that bad. Would you just take it easy?
Mark,
what?
Okay, at one point, I saw a light at the end of the tunnel.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, it's Jesus. He's come. Take me from this evil place.
And I'm taking he didn't come, I guess.
No, Jesus is afraid of Brooklyn, too.
Oh, come on.
You know, if that weren't bad enough, somebody told me this is Gay Pride Week.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the saddest three words in the English language.
Oh, stop it.
On Planet Bush, we have Gay Shame Year.
Oh, stay there. Come on.
Every year.
It's not right. Why do you say things like that, Lauren?
Every year. Okay. A bunch of them got on the train and tried to convert me.
No, they didn't.
While I was on the train.
It's not a religion.
Minding my business.
Come on. And how do you know they were gay, Lawton?
Mark, I have the gaydar.
Uh-huh.
Okay? I know the hens from the roosters. All right? There's these skinny little boys laughing and giggling like little girls. They smelled like fancy cologne. Gay Agenda by Calvin Klein.
Oh, stop it.
Everywhere.
That's wrong.
Smelled gay.
They did not. You're making all this up.
Oh, I wish I was. Every minute I spend in this liberal, multicultural, permissive, elitist, decadent hellhole is like some kind of bad dream I hope to wake up from. I pray that I'll wake up and look up at the ceiling at my poster of President George W. Two Terms Mandate Bush staring back at me, and everything will be back to normal. Bad dream, Dorothy. You're back in Kansas. You know what I mean?
Well,
I can't leave this place fast enough.
You know what, Lawton?
It was all a dream.
You know what, Lawton? It's too bad, buddy, because you're going to miss the parade.
What do you mean, parade? What are you talking about?
The Gay Pride Parade, Lawton. It's Sunday, and it's the biggest, wildest parade ever.
Parade?
Yeah.
You know, I'd like to see all of them parade right into the sewer.
No,
that's what I'd like
Lawton,
to see.
Lawton, listen to me, man. It's fantastic. There are floats and bands. It's
no.
Yes, it's a great time. Everybody dances and they're singing. And
stop it.
No, it's going to be great fun and you're going to miss it.
Stop it.
Yes.
Stop it.
Yes.
Stop it.
Yes.
It's a parade?
Yes.
Sunday. Yeah. It's a parade.
Uh-huh.
I want to do a parade. I wanted to be in that parade since I was 6 years old. My ticket was Saturday and now I can't go. I love Gloria Gaynor. I love Donna Summer. I made a showgirl costume with yellow ostrich feathers. People say I look just like Sandra Bullock in Miss Congeniality, too. I look just like... I never get to do anything fun because I'm stuck on stupid Planet Bush. It's so stupid. I'm coming out. I want the world to know. Got to
wow.
Let it
wow.
show.
Wow.
I'm coming.
What?
Ouch!
I didn't know you had to play that. I hate to stop you from singing this time, but we're going to be all right, man. This is a big day.
Yeah.
Oh, you all right? Take it easy, man. You all right?
Rats, Mark. I saw a rat the size of a Rottweiler.
Oh,
it had a baby in its teeth. It was coming for me next.
We can't go back there.
Coming
now,
for
Lawton.
Me next. Rats
right,
everywhere.
Right. Goodbye, Lawton. We
Bye.
Know who you are.
All right. God loves you. Deal with it.
I don't know, Riley. I think that today was a very monumental day.
I think we may see Lawton this weekend.
But wait, am I wrong or did Lawton just come out? Did that just happen?
Well, he did the Diana Ross thing. Which,
I mean, I don't know if there's no coming back from that, I don't think.
You no.
know, I think from here on out, this has changed everything. I knew it all along, I've got to say.
Yeah.
But this is a...
Log Cabin Republican action coming up.
This is, when is the parade? It's Sunday?
I believe it's this weekend, yeah.
It's huge. I haven't been there in a couple years.
It is a gigantic celebration.
You've been going for a long time.
For a long time.
Yeah. Now, has it grown in the years? I mean, when was the last time?
Oh, I mean, it was a relatively small thing to begin with. And there were a couple of years where they actually kind of bumped loggerheads with the city about what route they were going to take and whether or not the city was actually going to let them have it because it had expanded so quickly.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, it really grew very, very fast.
Yeah. Maybe I'm going to have to go down on Sunday then. Who knows what time it starts? Anybody? Noon? All right, Gay Pride Parade on noon on Sunday. I used to go to the one in San Francisco because it's like the entire city just turns into a party.
Yeah, yeah.
Do they have the Dykes on Bikes here open? Yeah, they do? That's great.
You name it, they got it here.
And there, I once saw a guy in San Francisco actually had like pierced nipples with nipple rings and a team of dogs hooked up to him. Nanook of the Castro. I wonder if that guy's going to be here. So let's talk about some other good news in the news. After being convicted 40 years to the day of the crime, Circuit Judge Marcus Gordon sentenced 80-year-old former KKK leader and part-time Baptist preacher Edgar Ray Killen to 60 years in prison.
Part-time preacher, full-time racist, and he's going away for the rest of his unnatural life.
So, talk to me again about they chose manslaughter because they didn't think they'd get the murder rap to stick because they don't have the evidence. Isn't that how that works?
Well, yeah. I mean, this was a case that should have been decided on state murder charges 40 years ago. Had they done it then, all of these geeks would have gone to jail for the rest of their natural lives.
And what did the guys, the other seven who were convicted in 64, who only did six, 7 years, what were they convicted of originally?
That was a civil rights violation
that
they were convicted of. Those were federal charges. The state of Mississippi never brought any murder charges against the guys that were convicted back in 67.
So that's mind-blowing that those guys are still around. And I guess, you know, justice has been served, and it's satisfying that this guy will die in jail. But it's like it's unsatisfying in the sense that there could be four or five guys that were involved in this still out there wandering around acting like they didn't do anything wrong.
Well, I hope that the state of Mississippi doesn't end up having to pay for his oxygen for the rest of his life. That's all I pray for.
All right, we're going to be back with DMC, Daryl McDaniels from Run DMC.
Yeah!
We're going to be back with Pendejo, the revolutionary.
Uh-oh.
It's 27 past the hour. We're at Tea Lounge in Brooklyn. You're listening to Air America Radio. It's Morning's Edition with Mark and Mark. Happy Friday.
You're listening to the best of Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
Good morning, it's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yeah.
You're listening to Air America Radio, Morning Citizen. We're coming to you live from the Tea Lounge in Park Slope, Brooklyn.
Yeah.
At Union Street and 7th Avenue. Go to TeaLoungeNY.com for some more information. DMC from Run DMC will be here shortly. But our good friend from Public Enemy fame, Chuck D, just stopped by.
Yeah.
Chuck D's got a show on Air America Sunday nights on the reel. How's that going, man?
It's great. On the reel, my co-host Gia Garrell, and we almost like treat like issues, and we treat it like pardon the interruption.
Yeah, okay.
And we learn from the manic pace of Mark and Mark.
Uh-oh. That's just caffeine.
Well, you got to be manic at 11 o'clock at night.
You do. What's up, Brendan?
Hey, Maron, yeah. We have somebody in the audience here. I think we want to maybe get on the air.
It's
our friend Pendejo. The revolutionary. I saw him here. Pendejo, you want to come up?
The guy from Buta?
Uh-oh.
Hey, man. Hey, it's good to see you, buddy. It's good to see you.
Pendejo.
Right. Okay. Pendejo. I'm just going to keep calling you that then. Pendejo.
Good. We need to get the name out there for...
For why? Why?
For...
Come on.
The revolution!
Okay, so everybody here, Pendejo was in jail. There was a bit of a mix-up at the Puerto Rican Day Parade, but he's out now, as you see. And, you know, you look a little tougher. I got to admit, you look harder.
Thank you, Mark.
Yes.
I noticed it, too. Back off, Brooklyn tea sippers! While I was on the inside, I saw things no man should see. Like Max Cady in the remake of Cape Fear, I became an animal bent on vengeance.
Dude, you were in the holding cell for like 2 hours.
See, Mark, 2 terrible hours.
Oh. All right, so you're hard now, man, and we've established that. So what's next for the revolution?
Well, Mark,
yes.
My recruiting efforts at my apartment building and at City Bakery weren't as successful as I'd hoped.
So it's still just you?
And Stompers.
Your Shih Tzu.
Who cannot be left alone.
Right.
Anyway, while I was surfing the internet...
Which is probably always.
Yes, pretty much, I guess. Am I telling the story here or you?
Forgive me, Pendejo. Forgive me.
Online, I read that another Latin revolutionary group that refers to itself as Al-Qaeda.
Okay, Pendejo, the Al-Qaeda actually, Al-Qaeda is actually Middle Eastern, I believe.
Yeah.
Interesting. I suppose now that I wish I had not checked the little box that put me on their mailing list.
That's not your best idea, man, I gotta say.
Anyway, they had a brilliant idea. Recruiting online.
All right, that could work. So where are you gonna start? Did you go to some liberal websites or maybe a radical extremist bulletin boards?
Actually?
Yeah.
Nerve.com. Nerve.com will be the apparatus I will use to bring down the neocons.
Hey, you, Pendejo, you know that's a dating site, right?
On the face of it, yes.
All right, so I assume you've written some kind of Nerve profile of yourself?
Yes, as a matter of fact, you can log on to Nerve.com and search Pendejo 68. That's PENDEJO68. Again, PENDEJO.
Okay, all right, they got it, all right. So you're looking for a certain type of revolutionary, right? Is that?
Yes.
Maybe you can tell us what your profile is, what you're looking for, Pendejo.
The type of revolutionary I'm looking for, let's see, blonde, blue eyes, 5'11 or taller, 112 pounds or less, no exceptions. Independently wealthy, a Virgo, dancer/actress. Interests include lingerie, modeling, and volunteer work. Must also be a nurturing earth mother who enjoys spooning, cuddling, and making banana walnut pancakes on Sunday mornings.
Ooh.
Books read must include the Narnia series, How to Please Your Man, and graphic novels like Constantine. Must love small, noisy dogs who require constant attention. A tolerance for various seasonal skin rashes a plus. And I wouldn't kick her out of bed for playing the clarinet. That's not an innuendo, Mark. I quite enjoy the music of Pete Fountain.
I'm sure you do, Pendejo. So now I can see how you'd want someone like that, but that kind of sounds less like you're trying to recruit revolutionaries and more like you're trying to get a girlfriend, am I...
I don't know what you're talking about. This woman would be an excellent recruit.
But you're a very, very lonely revolutionary, aren't you, Pendejo?
See, Mark.
I got to be honest with you, man. Those are some pretty tight requirements, and I don't really know if that woman exists, Pendejo.
Okay, I suppose I'd be willing to go up to 116 pounds. Oh, Mark, who am I kidding? I've never touched a woman... Are they soft? Do they tremble when you touch them? Do they squeak?
Oh, calm down, man. Dude, just take it easy. You'll find someone. Just be patient, all right? But like a revolution, a relationship can't be built in a day, all right? Pendejo? So maybe Nerve.com isn't the right recruiting platform. You hear? You okay? You dig?
You're right, Mark.
Okay.
Tomorrow, Match.com. I can tell by the pictures alone, they're chubbier, less interesting, and more desperate. Viva la revolución!
Oh, man. Well, good luck, Pendejo. All right. Sorry, Chuck. We had to do that.
Sorry, I know you guys are nuts. Apologizing for it. I listen to you guys every minute.
Oh, Lord.
So we were talking about Biggie and the case going to trial now. What do you think? What do you think happened?
You're
going to
ask me about Biggie?
Yeah, I am.
Nelson told you everything you need.
That's it. That's all I need to know?
Yes.
All right.
Blame Nelson.
All right.
Read the book.
Well, what have you been doing? Where have you been? What's been going on?
Working on the reel.
Yeah?
Uh-oh. Yes. Matter of fact, I think 2 weeks from now, we're going to do a special tribute to CBS 101. Because these are two stations I listen to. I work on Air America, but 101, you know, was a station I used to play, you know, have my kids in the car. Because, you know, when you tune the urban stations, it's too grown for them.
Yeah.
even if they're teenagers.
That's
now,
a nice word, grown.
Yeah. I raised my kids on the Four Tops, you know, if they're in the back seat, you know, they want to listen to Four Tops and Temptations and stuff like that, and Allman Brothers.
Because we get the email that says, I was listening to you with my kid and I was forced to have to explain something I didn't want to explain.
Well, it means I'm talking to the wrong person right now, right? No, let me stop.
But did that ever happen to you when you're in the car with your kid and they go, what is that?
Of course.
What do you say usually? That's grown stuff?
Well, number one, if the radio station got like past the Gavoisier and then they have the next record, it's getting hot in here, so I gotta take my clothes off. Down to my neck, my crack. I mean, I gotta have explanations or turn the station.
There you go.
How do you explain the Gavoisier?
Yeah, exactly, right? Especially with three kids in the back all singing it.
Yeah. Now, we should let the people that aren't here with us in New York know that CBS FM that Chuck's talking about just went away from oldies and went to Jack. Whatever that is.
Right.
It's grown.
Exactly. And for the life of me, I don't understand what Jack means.
Three more songs than a top 40 station.
Yo, really? All the music from the 80s?
No.
Except for mine?
Three more songs.
Huh? And hate's not a word I like to use, but the music from the 80s?
You hate the music?
I hate the music from the
80s. Billie Jean?
The early 80s. No, there's 5% of the 80s music that I like, but 95% was actually the reason I started to do music in the first place, to destroy that music. So, I mean, you know, all the stuff, you know, ABC and The Cure and all that stuff, you know, like, Carlo.
Yeah, you're talking about Maron's favorite band.
Whoa. Well, I was never a Cure guy, never wore eyeliner.
Chuck, another question for you, though.
I was a DJ. I had to play the stuff, you know. The Order, Screedy Politti, you know,
Screedy Politti?
You had to play them because those are the records that you're getting. And then, you know,
they're on tour with The Cure and Split Ends.
And then the funk bands at the same time came out, and then they got all confused trying to be like, you know, the post-disco. Disco was a wonderful music when it first came out, when they had real instruments. Gamble and Huff ushered that scene in.
They used to play it in the middle of the night, didn't you, Riley?
I used to go to clubs in the middle.
All right.
They look a lot like the T-Lounge.
Didn't you invent the dance format?
Marcus helped make some of that stuff.
Yeah, a little of this.
But you know, it was one of the reasons when Run-DMC came along, they ushered in a new era of basically cutting it right down to the root and being raw about the music. And they kind of really, Run-DMC was the group that actually made rap music legitimate from an album standpoint.
Oh, yeah, and it was, I mean, the rhythms were just extraordinary. The stuff they used, how they put that stuff together. But, you know, it seems like there's almost a renaissance of some of the old school hip-hop guys. I mean, Dr. Dre's got a new CD coming out. DMC's got a new CD coming out. Master P's got a new CD coming out. What is everybody trying to...
Sorry. No, sorry. Don't let me stop.
don't badmouth old person.
Where'd that come from?
Well, I don't, you know, really, I'm one of those cats that I don't care how much money you make. What does your money got to do with, you know, me liking the music? Yeah. People up there like saying, wow, so-and-so went platinum, so I must buy it. I'm like, that's programming, and I just think that, you know, Alpo goes, you know, double platinum if you want to count dog food cans every 2 weeks. I don't see the owner of Alpo walking around with diamond-encrusted dog food cans around their neck talking about, we went double platinum on dog food this week, so you got to get a couple cans, even if you ain't got a dog.
So we're talking to Chuck D.
Like it or you don't.
Yeah. We're going to come back with Daryl McDaniels, a.k.a. DMC.
Yeah.
You're listening to Air America Radio's Morning Sedition, live from the T Lounge in Brooklyn. It's Air America Radio. It's 44 past the hour.
This is the best of Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
This thing is 49 past the hour. We're listening to Morning Sedition. I'm Mark Mayer. That's Mark Wiley.
Yeah.
We're broadcasting live from the T Lounge in Park Slope, Brooklyn, at Union Street and 7th Avenue. What an amazing show it's been. This is Air America Radio. We've got Chuck D here hanging out. And right now, he's the DMC of the multi-platinum hip-hop trio. That was Run-DMC. He's got a new CD, Checks, Thugs, and Rock and Roll.
Coming out
in the fall, and a new single, Machine Gun, which is a cover of Hendrix's song, being released this summer. Please welcome DMC.
Hello.
Daryl McDaniel.
Scott.
How are you, man?
I'm very good, very good, very
good. So you're going to do a cover of Hendrix's song. That's
yeah, I did a record for the troops over there in Iraq.
Uh-huh.
Oh, wow.
Because, and the record, it isn't anti-war. It isn't pro-war. It's about the human side, that it's a war over there. Those are our brothers and sisters. Those are people's sons and daughters over there. People tend to forget that.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Very, very true.
So, yeah.
No, I was curious because, you know, Machine Gun is a song that very few people try to copy.
Yeah, I know.
It's one of those songs that, like, you know, I came up listening.
Well, actually, like, when I told people that I was going to do it, everybody was like, you know, well, you did Walk This Way, but how are you going to pull that off?
Because, yeah.
I mean, that is an amazing song, and if you listen to the version that Hendrix did, he did it live.
Yeah.
He just walked up to the microphone and was like, I'm going to do this for the soldiers over in Vietnam and over in Chicago and also the soldiers. Also, the record that I did is also about the soldiers over here dying every day. It's sort of like a semi-tribute to Jam Master Jay Biggie because the rappers and the MCs, they are soldiers over here fighting for, you know, equality and a righteous way of life over here for us. So it's not only about soldiers that are in the military. It's about soldiers like Chuck D and even you guys out here fighting for us and spreading the knowledge. So when I did the record, though, it was like, you know, everybody was like, okay, how are you going to pull that off? Because you really don't mess with a Hendrix song. But I didn't take nothing away from his music, because without that, like, it's not even really a remake. It's actually, it's Hendrix music with me just giving my commentary, bringing it up to date. Because when you look at the Iraqi war, the war in Iraq, 50 years from now, when they do the documentaries on A&E and Bravo and the History Channel, what's really bugging me out is, with all the power that the hip-hop world has now, and even rock and the musicians and the entertainers, there's nobody from this generation giving those folks over there something when they're sitting with their grandfather, I mean, with their grandchildren saying, I was in the war. When they play those documentaries 50 years from now, there's nobody who has the power of giving a music something to embrace. So I was like, wow. So when I seen what Hendrix did, I was like, okay, I'm going to do what Hendrix did for the soldiers in Vietnam, but bring it up to date now.
Yeah. It's optimistic, and I'm glad to hear the hope there, because it's sometimes when I think of the media 50 years from now, they're just going to be like, well, there was no history before the Republicans
exactly.
took over the world. That's my biggest fear. So, yeah, you're also involved in the Live Aid concerts.
Oh, yes. This, the other day, I got called back. I was at the first Live Aid. That tells you how old
really?
I am. Yeah, I was at the first Live Aid. Run-DMC, we performed at the first Live Aid. And since I had this new music out, Bob Geldof was like, you know, my people called and said, yeah, let's try to get DMC up there to do his new record. You know, they're thinking, you know, record sales and all
of that.
But for the cause, I always do everything for the cause. You know.
So which one are you doing?
I'm doing the one in Toronto.
Okay.
I tried to get on the one in Philadelphia, but it was so overbooked. But I think it's kind of cool to go over to Toronto and bring some of the energy and power that I have here to go over there and represent them, make
absolutely.
Them feel part of it. You know
yeah,
what I'm
absolutely.
Saying?
Toronto's a great city.
Yeah,
it really is.
You two guys are icons of this music. You've been in this game a long time.
Yeah.
What do you think of what you're hearing now out of hip hop?
What do I think? Well, that's it's so crazy. I mean, I don't say this. People always ask me this. I really, really don't really listen to hip hop anymore. And it's not because I don't like it. It's because the music and the ideas and the images and the foundation of it. It doesn't have nothing I could connect with. Really, with all I listen to,
really?
you'll hear it on my album, Chuck Stugs and Rock and Roll, I listen to classic rock. Now,
okay.
A lot of my hip-hop people always say, TMC, why do you listen to classic rock? That's old music. But I tell them it's not old to me because I never heard of a lot of it. Like Pink Floyd, Dylan, Doobie Brothers, Creedence Clearwater Revival. It's incredible music that you can listen to now and relate to it. And what
my
I'm trying to say about that is the thing about hip-hop right now is really talking about stuff that's not important. Like, hip-hop is supposed to be about the club and the party, and you could talk about, you know, the women and the cars, but also at the same time, you got to give a broad picture of the world. On my album, everybody has issues in life, whether it's politics, personal. My album's really personal. Like, I went through a time of suicidal thoughts, like,
My life has been crazy. I found out I was adopted 5 years ago.
Wow.
I found out that I'm Dominican, so with hip-hop right now, it's, yeah, my whole, like, I'm not, like, I really have that thing when you say you think you know, you have no idea. Because what people know about me, everything Chuck knows about me and y'all know about me is all I know about myself. So, but on my album, what I tried to do was talk about the messed up educational system, the messed up politics. I try to talk about stuff like, yo, my son is messing up in school. He's 10 years old. What are you doing? I try to talk about stuff that's going to relate to people, whether they're 3 or 300
doing
years
stuff.
Old.
Yeah, yeah,
you know what I'm saying? So the hip hop today, the hip hop today is not really, motivational and inspirational anymore.
Mm.
It's just a bunch of, you know, I ain't even gonna say corny ass records. It's just a bunch of stuff that DMC can't really relate to. And the classic rockers like Dylan and Lennon. Like, think about it. Dylan, Lennon, Springsteen, all those groups from the 60s. When there was a war, they made music and they
about
talked
the war.
About it.
Yeah.
Right, exactly.
You just made Dan Pashman very, very happy because you mentioned Bruce Springsteen.
Those are all my records. Did you agree, Chuck? Where do you stand on that?
Well, hip-hop started from the use of records, and it started from the research of musicians. And once it gets away from that, you know, it turns into something else. So, you know, DMC's my hero, so.
Right on. We got to get going. We got to get out of here. Thank you, DMC.
Thank you, Bill McDaniels,
Chuck D. Yeah. I'd like to thank the staff, Jonathan Steele, Greg Wolf, Oren Arnon, Michelle Harari, all here from the Tea Lounge. Go to TLoungeNY.com. It was great to have you. Thank you, Brooklyn. Thank you, listeners. You've really made this a great show for us. Gifford Miller, give a round of applause for Gifford Miller, Nelson George, rap pioneer Daryl McDaniels, a.k.a. DMC Chuck D.
Mark Wright. It's been fun, man.
It has been.
Loads of fun.
I will be at Bananas in New Jersey. The beautiful state of New Jersey tomorrow night in Hasbrook Heights. If you'd like to come down for that, and obviously next week we will be here in town all week long.
Yeah, now we got the 1 year anniversary of the handover of power in Iraq coming up next week. We're going to talk about it. We're going to have some live music. We've got some comedy. We got all of this. Good morning, Decision. Have yourselves a great day. Have yourselves a great weekend. Marion, it's been great.
It has been great, Riley.
Listening to the best of Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
It's Independence Day, and you're listening to the best of Morning Sedition with Mark and Mark. Hey, Fresno, welcome aboard. We're being heard on KFPT 790 AM, Fresno's Progressive Talk. And don't forget, we'll be back live tomorrow with Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. 6 past the hour, it's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley, the Marks on Morning Sedition here on Air America Radio. Good morning, geniuses.
Good morning.
Philosopher, kings and queens, working class heroes. Speaking of working class heroes, I was watching cable. That's always great about cable, is you never know what you're going to be surprised with. You're so rarely surprised. There's so rarely something on. I tuned into Imagine John Lennon, which came out in 88, that documentary assembled of Lennon clips and just, you know, interviews with him. And I was crying. I was crying because I don't know whether it was because of how much we all were familiarized with the Beatles, but this guy was a very genuine, beautiful guy who spoke his mind, not only in his songs, but later in his life. You know, the whole idea of protest in terms of, like, he was very sort of like, it doesn't matter what the intellectuals were saying or anything else. Peace is something we should really aspire to. And the only thing that I really know in my life is that I wish peace for everybody, and my reality is limited to the love that I feel in my life in its immediate circle. But I will, because of my public presence, you know, grow in front of you and speak my mind in front of you because I have no choice. But he was not a guy caught up with intellectual framings or even politics per se.
No, he wasn't. And see, I always thought that the Beatles represented something important in that they were
all working class kids. And remember that in Britain, the, you know, the class system is a lot more rigid than it is here in the States. But here were guys who actually transcended Britain's class system in many instances to make a difference in the world. It's interesting you mentioned that whole peace thing, because this morning I woke up and for some reason the proposal that Dennis Kucinich made, the congressman from Ohio, to actually, if he was president, construct a Department of Peace. For some reason, that stuck in my head all morning.
Really? That's weird that I'm bringing that then, because I really thought that the idea of aspiring to it, of realizing that it's a possibility, and what an amazing world would be to have that part of your head that realizes that, like, even when I was stuck in traffic on the highway because of Billy Graham's speech, you know, and I'm looking at other people in their cars and I'm seeing the amount of traffic and the amount of smog and the amount of people that are so selfish. Some days when you sit in traffic, you can really just look around and say, we're doomed because people's priorities aren't right. They're just not right. Everyone's got their own personal agenda, their own entitlements, their own desire to get to where they want to go when they want to get there with no regard for other people or the planet at large. And it was just beautiful to see this John Lennon thing and be moved to tears just by the very nature that, you know, because he had a public outlet, that all he was saying is that we could be so great.
Yeah,
you know,
if we were smarter.
Yeah. In an attempt to counter the latest polls, some saying that 49% of the people believe that he started the war and not Saddam Hussein. George W. Bush is designing...
What? That poll was hilarious.
I know. Unbelievable.
I love that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just, and it's a complete change of public tone. And now he's got to really put together his sort of like, well, it's a hard work.
Hard work.
Yeah. This is his whole pitch for tomorrow night at Fort Bragg. He's going to stand before the military, before the country, and feed us a line of hokum that's going to be unsurpassed.
Why don't you just go ahead and say it?
What?
He's going to pimp the soldiers.
Oh, that's for sure.
That's what he's doing.
It's just from all indications, not only is it a quagmire on the ground there, but the information coming out of the administration, out of the military, out of analysts, that there's a propaganda. One of the great propaganda techniques of the neocon death cult is creating a informational quagmire, so it becomes very difficult to see what the truth is. But the truth is that people on the ground, some of the military saying, look, this is unwinnable on a military level. Donald Rumsfeld has admitted that they've reached out and they're having talks with parts of the insurgency that are Sunnis and trying to integrate them into the political process. They are all unwilling to admit that they have to get out of there, that they don't have enough troops there to begin with, that people aren't signing up for the military like they used to, that you have troops that are overextended along the Syrian border, that it's a disaster.
Well, yeah, and when you have to threaten schools with, a withdrawal of federal funding just to get them to allow military people in the campus, you understand what George Bush has done, which is really to give the insurgents the gift of a lack of a plan.
Yep, and it's unbelievable that he had the condescension and the cojones to make a joke about it. Judy Keene of USA Today asked him a question about his second-term slump. And asking him if he's in one, and Bush responds, quote, a quagmire, perhaps, end quote, to make light of it like that. And then an Iraqi reporter asked him, quote, when will you begin the reconstruction in Iraq?
As soon as we find the $8.8 billion was supposed to fund it. That's when.
8.8 is like, that's just the part that's missing.
I know.
The other stuff, at least they know where the duffel bags full of cash went, to that guy with the khaki hat on, to that guy with the Halliburton suit on. You know, quote, and this is what he says. He says, Bush says, quote, we are spending reconstruction money, end quote. Then he goes, quote, but, you know, you need to ask that to the government. They're in charge. It's your government, not ours, end quote. We sent the duffel bags over there. How'd they get into the wrong hands?
Yeah, ask the Middle Eastern guy to my left over here. I mean, do you know how condescending it must be to have the head of the Iraqi government standing there and to have Bush tell a reporter, no, ask him.
Unbelievable. And on top of that, I am freaking out about Mad Cow.
I know.
We all know the neocon death cult is bad. We all know that they're liars. We all know that there's even more evidence out of England that it wasn't just a Downing Street memo, but there are other memos now that say that, you know, they were bombing Iraq in 2002. But what we don't know is that Mad Cow has probably been in this country for at least 10 years. The Agriculture Department confirmed that a cow that died last year was infected with Mad Cow. It died last year, people. Last year, all right? A test was conducted 7 months ago indicating that the animal had the disease, but the result was never publicly disclosed. This is a second case of Mad Cow disease in the United States. The first was in December 2003 from a cow in Washington State that was imported from Canada. Thank God at that time they could blame Canada. Who do they blame now? I'm telling you, man, this is scary stuff. And they had this cow was tested twice, all right? An experimental test was performed last November on the brain of the cow suspected of having the mad cow. Experimental, they said. Reed, if it had come out negative, it would have been a definitive test, all right? But this experimental test came out positive, all right? And because it became out positive, it did not give the results that the USDA wanted, so they called it experimental. And then they did another test shortly before the experimental test, referred to the USDA as their gold standard. What the hell does that even mean? You know what it means? It came out negative. So they went with that one. They said the first one was experimental, yet they didn't do the, what is it, the blue...
Western blot.
The Western blot test in England from a country where they've actually had mad cow cases. So they finally sent it into England at behest of what's that woman's name?
Phyllis Fong, Inspector General of the Agriculture Department.
There was enough fear that they had to do that, and it comes out positive. All right? It's just, it's mind blowing to me that the USDA is now, they're trying to blame the scientists on some level because Ed Lloyd, a USDA spokesman, quote, said the laboratory folks just never mentioned it to anyone higher up. They didn't know whether it was valid or not, so they didn't report it. This is in light of the experimental test. Like, scientists would do that. The nation's health
is at risk, but I'm going to tell you something, Maren.
What?
When you go home today, double lock your door, all right? Oh, I don't want anybody to go...
Yeah.
Maren?
It's a guy from the beef.
Maren, you're messing with our product, Maren.
Well, that's the whole thing. The reason that they don't have efficient testing here is it would slow down production. And the weird thing about this cow, this is the other thing that makes me the suspect, is like apparently, according to John Gifford, the USDA chief veterinarian, when the remains, the cow, the tissue samples were mislabeled. Because of a couple reasons. It could have been soiled with so much manure that it was hard to tell what breed it was. Or the brain tissues were mixed up with other tissue samples from other cows. Apparently parts from the diseased animal were supposed to be kept separate, but they somehow got mixed up with remains of four other cows. Could it be sabotage? I don't know. All I know is that all of this is going on. It's another, you know, it's the same type of propaganda the neocon death cult uses around Iraq. It's a propaganda of informational quagmire where there's so much conflicting information coming out. And after all, after all is said and done, we do have a case of mad cow in the country, and this country still feeds, you know, animal remains to cows, cow remains to cows through a bunch of different avenues.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Can you tell me exactly what dried restaurant plate waste is?
Yeah, it's like dried gross garbage, like, you know, a piece of meat that was all dried up and gross and rancid. You know,
and they just crush it up because they feed cows that, and they do it legally.
Well, let's just listen to this sound real quick of a guest we had on our show, John Stauber. He is the co-author of Mad Cow USA. Explained that although the Bush administration says that cows and livestock are not being fed back to other cattle, that is a lie. And this is actually the only way that this disease gets transmitted among livestock. So let's hear what John Stauber had to say.
We know now that mad cow disease is here in North America. It's been here for a decade. And despite that, the United States government is simply lying to the public about the safeguards we've taken. You know, mad cow disease is spread through feeding cows, slaughterhouse waste from cows and other livestock. We hear that we have a firewall feed ban in the United States that has prevented this since 1997. The reality is, no, that's not the truth. It's just a labeling restriction, and legally, hundreds of millions of pounds of slaughterhouse waste are fed back to cattle every year. The cattle industry simply won't give it up because they make so much money by turning slaughterhouse waste into animal feed, but other countries have banned it and are stopping the spread of the disease that way.
That was John Stauber from our show from last week. He was the co-author, is the co-author of Mad Cow USA. And just in closing here, in terms of this issue, I want to tell you what Agricultural Secretary Mike Johans said on Saturday. Quote, let's just reassure people there's nothing to worry about relative to BSE, which is the mad cow in beef. Our safeguards work to keep the animal away from our food supply. The fact that this animal was blocked from entering the food supply tells us that our safeguards are working exactly as they should. So there you go. Rest assured, people. Sweet.
Yeah.
We got Ted Leo coming up. We got Morning Remembrance coming up. And we got, man, it's going to be a great power punch to the end of this show. I'll tell you that. So that's all next. It's 17 past the hour. You're listening to Morning Sedition with Mark and Mark on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition.
Just to wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
Good morning. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio, and look who I see in the other studio. It's Ted Leo warming up.
Right.
He's going to tune up his guitar. He's going to have some coffee. He's going to get all jacked up and jam in a few minutes.
Yeah.
Right, how's that for pressure? Right now, thanks to everyone who, again, came down to Tea Lounge on Friday. If you missed it, we had a great time. If you want to see us again, we'll be at Vox Pop in Flatbush, Brooklyn next Friday, July 8th. We will?
Yeah,
that's not this Friday. It's a Friday from
a week from Friday.
Oh, okay. I'm glad to know we're gonna go there.
It's Flatbush now.
Yeah, Flatbush.
What's next, man? Hey, Coney Island, Canarsie?
Well, who knows? And I think we're trying to plan an outing up to Harlem.
Yes, hopefully
we'll get that. Maybe we'll
in the heart of the community.
We'll try and cajole Bill Clinton to come down from his office. But right now, unfortunately, it's that time of week. Well, maybe I should change my tone of voice then.
Really.
When we hear it, Morning Sedition. Take a moment to reflect at this time of sorrow, to reflect in our morning remembrance.
As the people of a grieving nation come together to mourn, to remember, and finally to find hope, Morning Sedition joins with them to mourn, remember, and find hope as well. And so we bring you the stories of those who have lost their lives, those who inspire us to carry on. Here now is Morning Sedition grief correspondent, Mort Mortensen.
Oh.
Oh, damn.
You all right?
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Vern Meisner, giant in the world of polka. Everybody loves a funeral.
Oh, man.
Vern Meisner, who once achieved an international following for his accordion-propelled polka tunes, died last week after an incensed obese woman crushed him against a beer barrel during the second verse of, "Oh, no, she's too fat for me. She's too fat for me. She's too fat for me."
Take it easy, man.
All right.
You want a Kleenex?
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, man. I love you. Oh, yeah.
All right.
Allergies.
Yeah, I know.
Got ficus in here.
Yeah,
maybe.
Yeah. Got one in my pocket.
Born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Meisner picked up his first accordion at age 8, and by 11 was playing in local bars while depressed out-of-work factory workers suggestively rubbed their kielbasas on his keyboard.
Oh, no. Oh, my.
Yeah.
It's rough, man. It's rough. Yeah.
Fans say Meisner sang and played polkas like no other, which isn't much of a surprise because no other would have wanted to. In his heyday, Meisner was heavily influenced by the popular songs and dance music of the 1960s, best illustrated by his breakthrough 1968 hit, Acid Barrel Polka.
I haven't heard that one.
Yeah. It's really trippy.
You all right there?
Guys, you been eating the slaughterhouse waste in
there? No, none of that.
Yeah,
I was a couple months ago, but...
No more.
I'm allergic to that. It's
okay.
Making my eyes tear up, I guess. Anyway, before he died, Meisner said he wanted to be remembered as the accordion player most responsible for influencing three generations of musicians to take up the guitar.
Yeah.
Jack S. Kilby, inventor of the microchip.
Hmm.
Jack Kilby, the modest and mild-mannered inventor of the microchip who revolutionized the world of electronics, died last week after finally realizing how many trillions of dollars he could have made had he not been so modest and mild-mannered. Kilby began his engineering career at Texas Instruments.
Okay, buddy.
Sorry, Brett. Yeah. At Texas Instruments, with a passionate desire to make things small. Little did he know he'd achieve his greatest success with his salary. Are you giving me the 1 minute mark?
Yeah.
Jesus Christ. This is Jack Kilby and microchip. Okay, look, I'll skip down to the bottom.
you can, all right.
Go ahead.
His death was announced by Texas Instruments, who at long last acknowledged his huge debt they owed him by giving his family a brand new plastic corpse protector.
Oh, no.
Kilby requested his body be combined with 100 million other dead electrical engineers, shrunk down to the size of a paperclip, and used to help bored teenagers take naked photos of each other with their cell phones.
Wow! That's something.
Yeah. He wanted to be buried like a microchip.
I get it. Yeah, it's good stuff.
I'm not making this up. What do you mean this is good stuff?
I'm sorry, buddy. Now you got Riley blowing his nose. It's a party in here. You like Ted Leo, Mort?
Oh, I love Ted Leo.
Oh, he's going to be here in a few minutes. He's going to come in here and jam, and he does jam.
Yeah.
And he's a very smart guy, and he's a politically active guy. We'll talk to him. We'll hear him play some music.
All right.
Thank you, Mort, Jim, for being here.
Thanks.
It's always great to see you.
Bye, Mark.
Hang out. Coming up next, Ted Leo's coming. Just hang out. Seasons don't feel
the reaper. You're listening to the best of mornings.
Sedition Radio Theater Company players bring you their production of Marc Maron and the Temple of Doom.
When we last left Mark and Grace, they were tied together in an empty abortion clinic as a bomb planted by Randall Terry ticked away.
This is the longest time bomb I've ever seen in my life. We've been tied up for 6 hours. Where's News Daddy?
Where's News Daddy, you ask? As a matter of fact, he's 20,000 light years from Earth, fighting an intergalactic battle against crime.
I'm looking for alien kingpin, Whack Whack Weehoo.
He's not here, but you can talk to his dark underlord, Sugar Smacks.
What up, funky spaceman?
I hear you and your oozing green homeboys are pushing kilos of high-grade squeak. Alpha Centauri is squeaked out, and I'm ending it right now.
You're pretty far out of your hood, News Daddy. Look around. Me and my boys are about to pump you full of protoplasm.
Your dope dealing days are over, you little green squeak freak.
I regard that as racist. Fire! You defeated us. We have never fought the likes of you before. What kind of creature cannot be hurt, cannot be shot, cannot be vanquished?
And look so funky fresh.
I'm News Daddy. Get on board. The planet is about to blow.
Wayne Gilman.
Meanwhile, back where Mark and Grace are tied up at the abortion clinic.
Hello. We're still here. Grace. Grace, do you have any ideas? Grace, wake up. Grace.
Will Grace wake up in time to avoid being blown to pieces? Will we ever see News Daddy again? Or will he time travel back to the only age that matters? The age of disco. Do you remember this one? That's next week on Marc Maron and the Temple of Doom.
Past the hour, Marc Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yo!
Sarah America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Thank you for being here. Our guest, who's been our guest many times, who's been on the same tour since the last time we talked to him, which was months ago. He's currently on tour with The Pharmacist. Their latest CD, Shake the Streets, was released last year. They just... Sheets.
Yeah.
Shake the sheets.
I was going to let that one slide, but yeah, it's early. Yeah.
Shake the sheets. Wow. Somebody has to be spoken to. And I, you know what's weird is I have the album, yet I still said shake the streets because it's sitting here in front of me on the paper, Ted. I'm going to shoot myself.
I've seen posters at clubs that have the record cover, which clearly says sheets on it, and then below it, the new album, Shake the Streets. Don't worry about it.
So you guys, this is Ted Leo, folks.
Yeah.
You guys just played last night at Irving Plaza, sold out.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How was it, man? Great?
It was great. It really was, yeah. I mean, from my perspective, anyway.
Are you able to take adulation? You know what I mean?
Yeah, not very far, you know.
Yeah.
I can take it, yeah.
I mean, I performed in New Jersey at a Holiday Inn on Route 17 the other night in Bananas Comedy Club, and people were, like, really excited. I had some real fans there, and I was sort of like, are you sure? You sure you like me?
Yeah, you know, it's like playing a sold-out Irving Plaza is something that has come late enough in life to me that you kind of, it's all...
You're ready. You deserve it.
Man,
right.
You know,
Yeah.
Or not even so much you deserve, but you just, you know, you just have a healthy distance from that kind of, you know, aspect of it. So.
And you've got great fans. I mean, you've got some real dedicated fans.
Truly, yeah.
I'll tell you, when you played, when we were in Boston, I think you played Spirit of Radio, and I swear to God, some guy's head almost exploded. Like, he just couldn't even believe, like, oh my God, Rush and Ted Leo. You remember that?
I do remember that.
He was going crazy, that guy. And so, you know, where are you going to be? You're going to be at Maxwell's tonight.
Yes.
And you are, you know, you're also, like, I remember talking to you about this before, you're vegan, so you heard about the mad cow thing. Were you sort of like, knew it?
I heard you talking about it earlier, actually, and I think I remember, did we have some, like, snarky interchange about that back in Boston?
I don't think I'd stopped eating meat.
You still were.
Oh, it was snarky.
Yeah.
Well, guess what?
I thought it was pretty snarky.
Oh! Well, I'm born again meatless, man.
Really?
It's been, like 4 months.
Uh-huh.
I'm still eating fish, despite being told by a woman in Brooklyn that I should really look at fish, because they're beautiful.
It's true.
You feel the same way?
I do.
So what do you like? What's it like? You're gonna, if let's say Ted Leo is like, I'm starving.
Yeah.
I want a big meal. Yeah. What does that look like?
A big meal with no meat or fish, man. There's a world of, you know, I mean.
So we're talking rice grains.
Sometimes.
Maybe a piece of cheese.
No dairy. You know, no dairy.
Strict vegan.
He's like
my younger brother. He's strict like that. Yeah.
Wow. So okay. So rice grains maybe.
Yeah. I mean also like I mean I like the fake cold cuts for a little sandwich every now and then.
You like the fake meat cuts?
I get into this argument with people sometimes because they're like, what is this? Blah blah blah. You know. But the thing is like,
which one is that?
You know that argument. You know.
Sure, I have it all the time.
Blah blah blah.
Well,
argument.
Yeah, we do it here a lot.
Yeah. But like, you know, I mean with the not to get, you know, too deep into this whole thing, but, I mean, the processed, like, cutlets that come onto your normal sandwich are so far removed from the source anyway at that point.
It's from the,
like,
animal, yeah.
Yeah, you're used to a taste and a texture, and, you know, and that's what it is.
Okay, so you're saying sort of like, well, it looks like cold cuts.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly. Yeah,
yeah, no, I have that. I recently bought some Boca burgers, which I've had before. Very, very good.
So, yeah,
a piece of spelt bread with some soy Swiss cheese.
You went all the way to spelt bread.
Yeah.
You went from eating meat to spelt bread in 8 months.
Congratulations,
Mark Maron.
My wife has a wheat allergy, so she can only eat spelt bread.
Right.
But I toasted and I got the Boca burgers with the soy Swiss cheese sprouts, some pickles and mustard. And that's like a Ted Leo sandwich.
Sounds good, man.
Can I call it the Ted Leo?
Yeah, you can call it the Ted Leo.
You want to play a song, man? Did you come here to play some songs?
Yeah.
Okay. So Ted Leo will be at Maxwell's tonight. The new album is Shake the Sheets.
Yes.
And we're gonna have Ted play a song here. Let's do it up. What are we gonna hear?
I'm gonna attempt to do one from the record called Counting Down the Hours.
Okay, cool.
In a sense, it never will. Accidents mean no one's guilty. Ignorance means someone's killed. So I asked out Mr. Miller how to get to where one's gone. And he points to his survival. And he points me down the road. And I go all alone, need a lot of love. Wondering if I've got a soul. Counting down the hours till it goes.
night in April on a street in Jersey where I went looking for some writing that I knew would not be there. And I punched out from the pelons and the police in the rain. We're concerned more with the car than with the fact the light had changed. But after listening all morning as I drove down 95 to a story of detainees who were barely kept alive, I could deal with trying to process pigeons acting like they're doves, but not with interference from the power lines above. As I go all alone, the lead a lot alone, wondering if I got a soul, counting down the hours till it goes. Precautions, yes, precautions. But if you're playing with a gun, you could kill someone. And in the dark, it's hard to know a friend. But I'm not angry. I won't be forever angry. Cause I'm walking toward tomorrow with a rifle in my hand. And I'm thinking about New England, and I'm missing old Japan. And I'm out near California where a spring runs hot and cold. And if I told you I felt ageless, would you tell me I'm not old? As I go all alone, a little out of low, wondering if I got a soul, counting down the hours till it goes. All alone, a little out of low, wondering if I got a soul, counting down the hours till it goes.
Right, Ted.
Ted Leo. Yeah. Amazing.
You do too much. You say too much.
Shake the Sheets is the new CD. They're going to be at Maxwell's tonight. I'm assuming that's sold out. In Hoboken.
In Hoboken, New Jersey.
You know, we're going to regroup here, and then you can decide whether you want to do another song.
Okay.
But either way, he will be here when we return with Ted Leo, and we're going to have the Cliff Notes and of me and Mark. So stay with us. It's Morning Sedition with Mark and Mark on Air America Radio, 44 past the hour.
You're listening to the best of Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
The hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. We're going to land this thing with Ted Leo, who you're listening to now, and you just listened to here and live in the studio the last, before the break there. He's still here. Ted Leo is on tonight is the last night of a tour that's gone on for how long, Ted?
Well, I mean, it's kind of essentially been like about 8 months or so.
Wow.
We've had a couple of weeks off here and there.
You know? So how does a tour, do you get people that follow you? I mean, in terms of...
style.
Are you the pop fish?
No. God, no. I sincerely hope not. You know,
not just a fish phenomenon, but I imagine that some of the people that were at Irving Plaza will probably be at Maxwell's. They probably are coming.
That could be, yeah. It's local. I mean, sometimes when we play somewhere, we haven't played other sort of regional, like, you know, you play Cleveland and not Detroit, and some people will come from Detroit.
Sure,
you know.
Yeah, I get it.
Now, Ted, I don't want to date myself here and sound like I'm too old school, but do you ever do gigs and then somebody from a record company, from one of the majors, comes up and says, listen, man, you know, we can really do something with you?
Very rarely.
But it has happened.
Yeah, it's happened, yeah.
And how do you react? Because you're still an independent recording.
Yeah, I usually say thanks, you know, maybe even meet with them to see what they have to say, and, you know, but usually kind of wind up walking away.
Right, we say thanks, and then thanks for lunch.
Yeah. I didn't say that, by the way. That was not me. I could get probably a couple more free lunches out of this.
So are you working on a new record?
We'll be starting on Wednesday of this week, actually.
Oh, there you go.
You're going into the studio on Wednesday?
No, I'm going into my bedroom and write some new songs on Wednesday.
Is that the process? You just sort of isolate and do it?
Yeah, kind
of. You got any big plans for the vacation outside of writing songs? You and your wife going anywhere?
Totally staying at home.
Hey,
good. And where is home?
I actually just moved up to Rhode Island a little while ago. So.
Rhode Island, that's not some place you hear people going to too often. Yay, I'm going to Rhode Island.
Yeah, well, let's keep that
quiet. Let's keep it
like that. Yeah.
Okay, I won't tell anybody. All right, so you want to? How's your voice feeling? You feel like playing another song?
I figure, yeah.
Okay,
there you go.
Go for broke.
All right.
Do a little Curtis Mayfield song and go down in flames or move on up.
I like the risk. We're living on the edge here with Ted Leo.
All right.
I got to keep on pushing. I can't stop now. Move up a little higher. Some way, somehow. 'Cause I've got my strength and it don't make sense not to keep on pushing. Now look yonder. Now what's that I see? A great big stone. Oh, they're ahead of me. But I've got my pride and I move them all aside and just keep on pushing. Hallelujah. Hallelujah. Keep on pushing. Keep on pushing. Now maybe someday, we'll reach that higher goal. I know I can make it with just a little bit of soul. I've got my strength and it don't make sense not to keep on pushing. Hallelujah. Keep on pushing. Amen. 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 Amen.
Yeah.
Wow, that was...
He did it justice. Now, you know, that song was one of those gospel pieces that not everyone took as a protest song right away.
Right.
But the fact of the matter is Curtis Mayfield really made his bones doing protest music.
Oh, yeah.
And Keep On Pushing was part of that whole gospel double meaning kind of song.
Right. That sounded great, man.
Yeah,
your voice is right on the edge. We're talking to Ted Leo. We're listening to Ted Leo. Now, do you... Like, I've heard people refer to you as sort of a politically active, a sort of a pop statesman of the left. How do you feel about that?
Pop statesman of the left? Well, you've got something to live up to now.
You can use that. What are some of the things that you've been pretty passionate about and involved with lately in terms of political activism?
Well, first of all, being on tour every night is you know, an amazing opportunity.
Absolutely.
To actually discuss things. And, you know, most of my songs have political content, so there's that kind of conversation that goes on with the audience every night.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that, I actually have been trying to do as many kind of interviews with political organizations, Center for American Progress, you know, things like that, just to get, like, you know, get kind of youth involved in things that more than anything just keep them informed, because that's one of the biggest problems, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, just take the Downing Street memo, you know.
Sure.
It's been out there, you know.
Sure.
Like, you know, it's like you, you have to, like, you really have to go the extra mile with the media these days and keep yourself informed.
And you're helping get young people, you know, into that process of,
yeah,
of trying, realizing
yeah, like,
that. Yeah, that's great, man. Ted Leo, thanks for being with us. The latest CD is called Shake the Sheets. He'll be at Maxwell's tonight, and he's going to go home to where he lives in an undisclosed location and sit in his bedroom and write his next CD this week. It was great seeing you again.
Thanks, you guys. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Ted.
Sure. Thanks for coming. There's the sound of the fax machine with the liberal agenda. It's our weekly liberal agenda from the Streisand compound. So here are your marching orders for this week, liberals. Write these down. One, protest the use of the term mad cow disease as disrespectful to the morbidly obese mentally ill. Two, for the fourth year in a row, offer therapy and understanding for our attackers.
Wow.
Three, call Bush's bluff and take a tour of Guantanamo. Note, make sure to dress like indigenous Cubans so as not to spread ugly American image. Four, for the 4th of July, develop a firework rocket that shoots up in the air, explodes, and spells out the Downing Street memo in red, white, and blue lights. Five, today's phrase, just drop it into conversation. Hey, isn't Iraqi Prime Minister Ibrahim al-Jafari just Hamid Karzai without the stupid hat? Wake up, sheeple. Bush has more puppets than Jim Henson.
Lord.
How do you like that? Tomorrow, we're going to get into Iraq on the day of the eve of Bush's address to Fort Bragg on the year anniversary of the turnover. Iraq, he's going to try and sell his BS bill of goods to the public and to the military, and we're going to have Noah Feldman, who helped draft the original Iraqi constitution for the interim government, discuss what he sees in the future of Iraq.
Not only that, you know, they elected a hardline president of Iran, right next door to Iraq, and Borzu Dereghahi, Pulitzer Prize nominated journalist and one of the regulars on our show, friend of the room. Mm-hmm. He'll be here. He'll discuss Iran and Iraq. And we're going to have someone named Peter Kaminsky talk to us about something neither of you guys mess with anymore. Ham!
The perfect search for ham.
The
Noah Feldman
search.
Also on the state of Iraq's political process. I already said that, didn't I?
Don't worry about it.
Now I said it twice. Noah Feldman. Now I said it three times. Noah Feldman.
Can I say
He's
it once?
Four. Yeah.
Noah Feldman.
All right. It's been great seeing you, Riley.
Great seeing you. Thanks, Ted.
Thanks,
we'll
guys.
Do it all again tomorrow on Air America Radio.
It's Independence Day, and you're listening to the best of Morning Sedition with Mark and Mark. Hey, Fresno, welcome aboard. We're being heard on KFPT 790 AM, Fresno's Progressive Talk. Don't forget, we'll be back live tomorrow with Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. It's 6 past the hour. You're listening to Morning Sedition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hi.
It's Air America Radio. It's Wednesday. I hope you're having a decent morning. Hope you got your coffee going, whatever you do to make you feel okay at the beginning of your day. On the phone, very excited. Senator Russ Feingold introduced a resolution in the Senate earlier this month calling on the White House to create a timetable for both achieving goals in Iraq and for the withdrawal of U.S. troops. Now we'll find out if you like what he heard from the president last night, whose speech seemed to focus around not withdrawing the troops and not providing an exit strategy. Senator Russ Feingold joins us on the phone from Washington, D.C. Good morning, Senator. We're going to make you an honorary co-host.
Well, good morning, and I appreciate all these opportunities. This Iraq situation and the failure to focus on the fight against terrorism in the proper way is so disappointing that I really do want to have more and more people speak out against this administration's policy.
It seems like there was a point, if we could hear it right now, in his presentation, if you just listen with us for a second, Senator.
Sure.
And we fight today because terrorists want to attack our country and kill our citizens, and Iraq is where they're making their stand. So we'll fight them there. We'll fight them across the world. And we will stay in the fight until the fight is won.
Now, what's interesting about that, aside from it sort of committing to a eternal and perpetual war that has not no significant definition, is that that audience response apparently was prompted by a White House advance team member. And it seems to go directly against and in support of everything that you are standing for right now.
Well, this whole thing, and the president made it very clear last night he wasn't going to tell us anything serious about what we're going to do in Iraq,
mm-hmm.
or we're going to ever get out of there. This is all based on a huge fabrication. You can call it the big fabrication.
Okay.
Conning the American people into believing somehow that Iraq and Saddam Hussein were involved in 9/11. And nobody believes that anymore. And so he uses all the emotion and all the rhetoric that relates to what happened in 9/11 to support an intervention in Iraq that everybody is shocked was based on such bizarre justifications that haven't held up. So this is all he's apparently got left. He won't talk seriously about a time frame for accomplishing the goals he talked about. He won't give us any kind of vision of when the American people can expect the men and women who are fighting so bravely can come home. He gave us nothing other than these same slogans and cliches. And I was watching some of the coverage on TV. Even some of the soldiers and military leaders at Fort Bragg said, you know, it was a great speech, but we are concerned about an indefinite commitment there. So I'm not even sure the audience there was buying these cliches that have been offered for years.
And isn't it safe to say, Senator Feingold, that at this point, the presence of the Americans and what's going on, the chaos that's going on in Iraq, from all from very valid sources, that we are generating a new breed of terrorists there, and that because of that, that simultaneously generating terrorism and fighting at the same time is sort of guaranteeing this eternal struggle?
Well, I think that's exactly what's happening. When the president says we have to remember the lessons of 9/11, I don't think he has any understanding of the lessons of 9/11. What 9/11 is about is what happened in Afghanistan, where a bunch of terrorists were trained because they had a target to practice against, and that was the Soviet Union. And the Soviet Union came, basically fell apart in large part because of the enormous failure in Afghanistan. We are setting ourselves up for the exact same situation. We are the drawing card. We are the fuel for terrorists to come into that region, as well as the recruiting of Iraqi terrorists now. And that's exactly how they are fueling this insurgency, because we are the great target. We are in this place. Somehow the president thinks it's beneficial to us to make, or he thinks all the terrorists are making their stand in Iraq, and we're going to get rid of them all there. But that's not what Porter Goss, the head of the CIA, said. He said they are training there, getting tremendous training in urban terrorism and urban warfare, and that they are successfully exporting these same people to other places. And if you take a look, there is, for example, the beginning of terrorist attacks in Kuwait that weren't there before. So it seems that the president continues with this tunnel vision. He's locked into this idea that the whole thing was about Iraq. It was never right in the first place. It's not right now. And our troops are being asked to do something that doesn't make sense in terms of fighting the overall war against terrorism. That's why we need a vision of how to finish the mission, and we need a timeline that would be flexible to allow us to imagine what kind of scenario would allow us to finish this.
Our guest is Wisconsin Senator Russell Feingold. Senator, isn't the president to some extent playing for time here? Wasn't that really what last night's speech was about, that the longer he plays for time, the longer he asks for patience from the American people, that maybe they'll get a constitution in place in the month of August, maybe they'll actually have elections, maybe he can still turn this thing?
Well, I mean, hopefully that's the motive. I have a feeling it's because the public opinion polls in this country, including in very conservative areas and in military areas, areas where there's a lot of military, are going into the tank. And, you know, how many times are they going to point to something, whether it be, you know, mission accomplished on the ship, or whether it be the transfer of sovereignty, the capture of Saddam Hussein, the elections earlier this year? Each time they go, okay, if we can just get this, everything's going to turn around. Now they're talking about the Constitution. But that flies in the face of this insurgency. I was there in February, and they were saying, well, look, Russ, it's not that bad. We only have 50 or 60 attacks a day. Well, now they have 70 to 80 attacks a day. We have far more Americans being killed than we thought would be killed at this time. This insurgency is obviously in a very strong position, and I think, as you indicated, we're helping making it stronger. So I don't understand this rationale.
Senator, the president made much of the fact that there are now 160,000-odd Iraqi security forces. You were in Iraq in February. What is your best information about how many of them are actually trained enough to fight on their own without the assistance of American troops?
Well, that's exactly the point. I was there with Senator McCain, Senator Clinton, and others, and we asked General Petraeus, right in the green zone. They're about these numbers. And he gave us the numbers. Actually, the numbers we got there were smaller than the numbers the president cites. And Senator McCain noted that the numbers were lower that we were getting there than in Washington from Rumsfeld. But in addition, there were real questions about how prepared these folks are. The president even indicated that many of these people are, some of these people are more ready to do what they have to do than others. So this is an inflated figure in my view. We're a long way away from having the training of the military and the police that would be necessary. And that's why I think the president should give us a time frame. When he thinks, when would it be possible? When can we imagine that this kind of expertise could be developed so that we can imagine that the Iraqis could stop the insurgency themselves and that we could imagine bringing home the men and women who have already given so much?
He'd probably answer you by saying when the nation is entirely bankrupt.
Well, that's how it seems. I mean, I have, frankly, I've never seen a situation that is more loaded with cliches and phony arguments. This is one of the most disturbing moments in our recent history, and the president, I think, is almost completely failing.
Yeah, he plays Senator Feingold, he pays a lot of lip service to progress being made. Now, you were there in February, and for some reason, when they say this about schools and infrastructures, after I've heard the stories about, you know, billions of dollars being lost, money being tossed around in duffel bags and numbers like, you know, $2.5 billion here and there, and I get the feeling from everybody we've talked to that if there is progress, it must be a five-block radius tucked away in the green zone as a model neighborhood. I don't know. What do you know about that?
It's hard to know how anyone would know. I asked the people right there in the green zone, both military people and our State Department people, you know, we've got $20 billion set aside here, $20 billion, more than the entire foreign aid budget for the rest of the world for reconstruction. They said, given the security, how do you get out there and check? Well, it's pretty tough, they said. We've put unmanned vehicles out to take pictures to see if maybe they built a wall. This isn't good.
Oh, no.
Senator, one of the things the president did was to ask Americans to fly the flag on the 4th of July next Monday to try and help military families. Does he get any traction when he tries to tug at America's emotional heartstrings that way?
I think it's fine that he asked people to do that. I think it's a good thing. The troops need to know that despite the disagreements we have in the policy, that as Americans we understand that what they are sacrificing, what they are doing is way beyond what anyone could imagine to have asked. So I think it's great that there'll be that support. If it gives the president some kind of boost, fine. It won't last as a political ploy any more than anything else has. The reality is the deaths are going up of Americans. The reality is the insurgency is very strong. The reality is that we don't have a plan to finish this job and to get our troops out of there. And that's his problem. And he has done, in my view, absolutely nothing to solve his problem.
And you're going to help solve it by introducing your resolution tomorrow to the Senate. Is that true?
I introduced it a couple weeks ago.
Oh, it's 2 weeks.
And,
okay.
We're going to try to figure out some way on one of the appropriations bills, one of the upcoming bills, to offer that or something like it as an amendment. And it's very modest. It just says, look, Mr. President, would you please give us a plan within 30 days? And we could have required it. We could try to set the date ourselves, which I don't think is really what Congress generally should be doing. We could try to cut off the money, which I obviously have voted against. But how about just as a first step, asking the president to do his job?
That sounds good to us.
Vision of what's going on here.
That sounds good to us. Senator Russ Feingold of Wisconsin, really appreciate you being with us again. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you very much, brother.
Thanks, Senator.
You take care. I love talking to that guy.
Yeah.
Build a wall.
It's incredible.
Yeah. It's 16 past the hour. You're listening to Morning Sedition with Mark and Mark on Air America Radio. When we come back, I'm sure we're going to talk more about Bush's speech, and we're going to talk more about the situation in Iraq, but we've also got other stuff, you know, on the menu. We've got, you know, we're going to talk about racism fairly specifically in just a few minutes. So stay with us. It's 17 past the hour.
Join the Morning Sedition.
Right now,
call 866-303-2270.
What?
That's 866-303-2270.
You don't know until you've tried this.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Damn good.
21 past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Of course, we've been talking about the folk Christian AWOL ex-blow monkey puppet of the Cheney regime's neocon death cult, George W. Bush's speech last night at Fort Bragg, justifying his faulty policy of generating terrorism and simultaneously fighting it for a war that could go on forever in the name of war profiteering and exploiting a global tone of fear in order to maintain power. That's the way we're looking at it here. In light of that, exactly. In light of that, exactly. In light of him not being honest about the fact that we are generating terrorists on a daily basis. Can we hear that, Chris?
The progress in the past year has been significant, and we have a clear path forward. To complete the mission, we will continue to hunt down the terrorists and insurgents. To complete the mission, we will prevent Al-Qaeda and other foreign terrorists from turning Iraq into what Afghanistan was under the Taliban, a safe haven from which they could launch attacks on America and our friends.
No, instead they're going to create an environment where Iraq is like Afghanistan, you know, under the Russians, where they're going to create a new generation of terrorists. Perhaps George Bush has not read the December 2004 report from the CIA's National Intelligence Council stating, quote, the Al-Qaeda membership that was distinguished by having trained in Afghanistan will gradually dissipate, to be replaced in part by the dispersion of the experienced survivors of the conflict in Iraq. Iraq and other possible conflicts in the future could provide recruitment, training grounds, technical skills, and language proficiency for a new class of terrorists who are professionalized and for whom political violence becomes an end in itself. So what George Bush is saying is that he is guaranteeing eternal warfare. So if you're a soldier and you didn't understand that, I sympathize, because we have a president that is being disingenuous, that exactly what they want to create, the neocons, is a global culture of perpetual war.
You know, when you talk about the soldiers, Mark, he did say, you know, fly a flag on the 4th of July, help military families. And that's all well and good. But why in the world could his administration have not helped military families? He knows there's a recruitment problem. Why doesn't he get the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Army and the Navy and Air Force secretaries together and develop some financial incentives for these people? Why not develop a recruitment bonus? Why not develop a retention bonus? Why not do some things to sweeten the pot so people will in fact believe that their service is valued somehow?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In a few minutes, we're going to be talking to Gary Young. He's from the Guardian newspaper of London, who recently traveled to Philadelphia, Mississippi, to get a sense of the state of race relations in the South. And, you know, in leading up to talking to Gary Young, I want to talk about a story. This is in reference to a report released by the Journal Social Psychiatry and Psychiatric Epidemiology. The author, a guy named John Zeber, who studies quality, cost, and access issues for the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs. So the study was done on veterans, claims that although schizophrenia affects all ethnic groups at the same rate, blacks in the United States were more than four times as likely to be diagnosed with schizophrenia as whites, and Hispanics were more than three times as likely to be diagnosed as whites as well. And the study basically gets into the fact that differences in wealth and drug addiction and many other variables did not explain the disparity, and the culprit was indeed race. So this confirms that minorities are more likely to be misdiagnosed as having serious psychological problems than whites.
Yeah, and there are a number of reasons for this, and part of it, and see, what's happening now, Mark, mm-hmm. is that people are going back and re-diagnosing these people, taking a second look, and in many cases, what they thought was schizophrenia turned out to be depression over some very real issues. In one case that was mentioned here, they talked about a guy who was, uncommunicative, etc., was diagnosed as schizophrenic and delusional because he kept talking about somebody having killed his son in a hate crime. You know what it turned out? His son was killed in a hate crime.
Well, I think it seems that a lot of the problems occur when you have people with cultural differences, like a clinician and a patient, who are doing the interviews, okay?
Yeah.
And either there's a translation problem or there's literally a cultural problem. When you have, you know, a community, like some in some parts of the black community, where they have rightful paranoia, rightful fears of how they're being treated culturally, and that's misdiagnosed as paranoid symptoms,
yeah.
Then, you know, they're not being sensitive to cultural issues. And this is a real sort of it's a strange point in the hardline psychiatric community, which sees this as political correctness intruding on the science of psychiatry, which is really how it should be looked at, is the cultural evolution of psychology, honoring the diversity of the American public.
Well, yeah, and see, the other thing, Mark, is that if people sense that they're being either misdiagnosed or not being paid the proper respect, you know what happens? They don't go back.
Yeah,
they don't go back to that psychiatrist. They end up dropping out of a lot of these stuff.
Yeah, this was a very provocative piece here. And we're going to be talking to Gary Young about Mississippi specifically, and maybe about institutional racism on a broader level coming up next. So stay with us. It's 27 past the hour. You're listening to Morning Sedition with Mark and Mark on Air America Radio.
You're listening to the best of Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Four past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. All morning we've been talking about George W. Bush and the neocons, death cults leader there, of, you know, sort of justifying the policy of generating terrorism and fighting at the same time for till the end of time. We'll be talking about that a little more in a little while. And now we're going to switch gears. There's more to racism in the South than the murders of Cheney, Goodman, and Schwerner. In fact, according to our next guest, the conviction and sentencing of Edgar Ray Killen last week hardly begins to address the issue. Gary Young is the New York correspondent for the London Guardian. His piece, Racism Rebooted, appears in the July 11th edition of The Nation. He's also the author of a book, No Place Like Home, A Black Britain's Journey Through the Deep South. He joins us live in the studio this morning. Good morning, Gary. How are you?
Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
I'm glad you're here. So how close does the conviction in the senator and sentencing of Killen come to really, I mean, I read the piece in The Nation. It just seems like it only scratches the surface in even addressing the South's racism problem.
Yeah, I mean, it's symbolic,
mm-hmm.
and symbols are important, but you should never mistake them for substance. And the real substantial issue, not just in the South, but I think the whole of America, is institutional racism that keeps black people unemployed and, the first to get fired, the last to get hired, the first to be arrested, the longest to be sentenced, and so on and so forth. And that what you have in these trials is a very convenient fall guys, in a way. Not that I'm glad that Killen was convicted. He should have been convicted. He probably should have been convicted for more than he actually was. But you arrest an 80-year-old white man, you don't really solve the problem of racism and bigotry in the South or in America. It's very convenient to dump that on an old guy.
So it's a temporary relief in the sense of it seems like justice is being served at least in one case, and you get sort of a relief from that, but it doesn't really address the core issues, which the racism that infiltrates all of the culture.
That's right. The editor of the local paper, the Neshoba Democrat, who I'm pretty sure was a Republican, but in any sense, whatever he was, he said to me, he's a white guy, and he said, there is equal opportunity here in Philadelphia, Mississippi. There is equal opportunity in Mississippi. If you want to do something, then you can do it. I said to him, well, then how do you explain that African Americans are more likely to end up in jail or least likely to end up in employment and earn half as much as white people, unless you just think they're lazy and stupid?
Mm-hmm. Gary, you traveled through the Deep South. And as someone who grew up in Britain, were there things that you expected to encounter that you did not, and were there things that you did not expect to encounter that you did? Did you go down there figuring, you know, I'm going to be down there with a group of white racists?
I figured that the casual racism would be greater than it was,
mm-hmm.
Actually. I've only had one serious racial incident in the South. That happened in Philadelphia a few weeks ago when I stopped to ask directions at the house of three of white people who sit on the porch. They're the only people out. I asked the directions, and their response was, "We've got a gun. We're going to shoot you." And so I asked again.
"We've got a gun. We're going to shoot you."
So I asked again, and they came up with the gun thing again, and then the guy went back into his house to get his gun, at which point, you know, I made my excuses.
You figured you'd go to the other side of the track to ask directions, huh?
That's mind-blowing. It almost seems like, you know, he's honoring every stereotype that anyone assumes would be.
I know. It was almost as if I'd stopped and said, "I'm looking for a stereotype, an old Southern racist. Could you help me out here?" So, I mean, so in that sense, but otherwise... You know, it's actually a kind of very, very kind of straightforward experience going to the South, partly because I'm not looking for a house. I'm not looking to put my kids in a school. I'm not trying to marry anyone who doesn't look like me. I'm just driving through in a rail car and staying in motels. If you're doing that, you're not going to get a Klansman come bashing on the head.
Now, there are some people, and I know that the South has projected this over time because I've seen it in my own experience. There are people who will say that black people who live in places like Philadelphia, Mississippi, have some kind of bond with whites that transcends race. And sometimes you will get black people in Mississippi who will look at you as an outsider the same way whites do. Did you experience that at all?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, in the same way that for all of the racial differences in America in general, you're all Americans, right? You come to Britain, and the first thing I think, is...
Yay!
Yeah. And in the same... You know, they eat the same food. I mean, they listen to similar music. It's not the same music.
Not David Banner, I guess.
No, not quite David Banner. You know, in many, many ways, the whole myth of segregation was odious because white people were raised by black people. They were breastfed by black women. They slept with black people. Quite often, they lived in their houses because most slave owners did not own a huge amount of land. Mm. And so it was really always about white supremacy. It wasn't about... You could be as close as you liked so long as you knew your place. And they used to say that the difference between the North and the South is in the South, it doesn't matter how close you get, just how big. And in the North, it doesn't matter how big you get, just how close.
All right. Well, it's interesting in your piece that you say that there is actually a cottage industry based in racism in Mississippi, in Philadelphia, Mississippi, based specifically around the case of the three civil white workers killed in 64.
Yeah, there is an intense, and this has been going on for 20-something years, mm-hmm. an intense effort in the South to rebrand the South as a place that conquered its history. And I was reading today about this Iraq story, and Dawn Bartlett saying, look, the past is the past, and we just, you know. And that's kind of, that is where an awful lot of the South would like to go. Look, let's just travel light, free from any baggage of history, and let's just put all that stuff behind us. You can vote now, shut up.
Yeah.
But one of the problems I think in engaging with any kind of conversation about the South is that you have to also take into account the North.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, the North, there is a very smug feeling that people in the North have about the South, that there's, you know, Southerners are crazy and we're not. If you're looking for the most segregated cities in America, they're all in the North. Milwaukee, Chicago, Newark, Philadelphia, the further south you get, St. Louis, are the top 10 segregated cities.
I used to live in Boston. I still, to this day, don't know where the black people are there.
Right. But they're somewhere.
Yeah, they've hidden them somewhere.
Right. Gary Young, you've spent this time in the South. How would you recommend that people there, regardless of race, get rid of the stain of racism that has really hung over that region like a cloud for so many years?
I would say two things, and the first would be to have an honest appraisal of your history, to understand, you know, there were some funny moments in that trial where, say, the prosecutor said to Killen's brother, "Do you know that your brother was in the Klan?" He said, "No, but the way I think of it, or the way I've heard it, your daddy and your granddaddy was in the Klan." And that was probably true. I mean, this entire town colluded in this murder. So there's no point in just stopping at this one person. So an honest appraisal of the history. And the second thing, I'm always frustrated in Britain at how rarely British people will honestly acknowledge race. It's like sex, politics, and religion. You just don't mention it in polite company. Mm. I'm always frustrated here at how rarely people discuss class. And I think that one of the roots out of that, there are a lot of poor white people in the South too. And until they understand that, or until they make common cause with a whole lot of poor black people and realize that actually poverty is their central issue, their lack of housing, their lack of health care. You take any indicator of health or wages or whatever, Mississippi's near the bottom, and then just halve it and you get the rate for black people. So you have an intensely, a group of intensely poor people where black people are even poorer. And without some discussion of class, I can't see how they kind of beat their way out.
It's not even part of the cultural language here.
No.
The word class doesn't even exist in terms of differentiating, really. There's a lip service paid to middle class.
Yeah, but then you think middle between what and what? Because
exactly.
Nobody ends up to be a working class, and very few people end up to being rich either.
Mm-hmm.
Do the classes, white and black, for example, do white and black middle class in the South, and particularly in terms of your experience, did you find that they mixed a lot? Were they comfortable with each other in public facilities, that sort of thing?
No. Almost at work they do, because they have to. But that otherwise, no, the African-American middle class has its own space. The white middle class has its own space. And there are good reasons for this. You know, not good as in favorable, but it's only been 50 years since, I mean, we forget how recently, only 40 years ago, African Americans couldn't vote. You know, they didn't have a guaranteed right to vote. And so this is kind of one of those, like, in our lifetime kind of things. And so I did a lot of work in South Africa during the first elections and went back quite
94, sure.
Yeah. And, you know, if you go to South Africa in the year 2034, it's not all going to be right. You know, there's still going to be a lot of work to do. It took several centuries to make it that bad. It's going to take a long time to make it better. The problem is when you see things kind of, or you feel that things are going in entirely the wrong direction, that they're not making things better, they're actually making things worse and entrenching the problems.
Did you feel that in Philadelphia?
Well, what I felt was that this trial could be one of those, understanding of this trial could go one of two ways. Either we're going to wash our hands now, we've dealt with that. We've dealt with everything that was bad about Philadelphia. Let's move on and forget it. Or it could be, let's look at how that trial, what that trial meant to. You know, Killen once said, you know, that he was working to preserve the Mississippi way of life. Well, that way of life is still there. You know, Cheney, Goodman and Schwerner's work still hasn't been completed.
Sure.
And until that's done, then any understanding that you can now bury those people and the ideas that went with them is a step backwards, I think.
Our guest is Gary Young. I want to thank you for joining us. The book is No Place Like Home, A Black Briton's Journey Through the Deep South. And you can also see his most recent article called, what was it? Was it Racism Rebooted at www.thenation.com. It's really a pleasure talking to you. Thanks for coming down today. What do we got? The war? What is it?
War on Brains.
That's coming up next, and more on the horrendous display by Bush last night. It's 45 past the hour. You're listening to Morning Sedition with Mark and Mark. It's Air America Radio.
Hi, this is Rob Corddry from The Daily Show, here to remind you that when top news reporters and investigative journalists like me want their news skewed so far to the left it's wearing a dress, we turn to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yo!
The show is Morning Sedition. The network is Air America Radio. We'll be talking more about the Bush speech in just a few minutes. We got Robert Klein
going to
come in a little later.
Yeah.
To comedically bloviate about the Bush speech and other things, I'm assuming. But right now, every week we bring you the latest news from the front lines of the four-year global war being waged by the Bush administration. And here with today's dispatch from the War on Brains is war correspondent Mort Milfington.
Dateline, the Pentagon, the world's largest office structure, yet so efficiently built, It only takes 7 minutes to move between any 2 points in the building, especially when you're running from a plane. The war on brains continues, you unrepentant, echo-booming, sofa-assed heroes of the Burger Wars. While you were busy creaming over Avril Lavigne's latest pseudo-punk foray into fake teen angst, the neo-con desk militia at Fort Bumble began a relentless march into the from their family circus-covered cubicles deep into your bedrooms, where they're now rifling through your Blockbuster receipts and sniffing your yoga mats. Last week, the Department of Defense, or DOD, announced the inevitable, that it was ready to collect personal and confidential information on 16 to 18-year-olds for a new Army recruitment database designed to help America do two things. One, kill more insurgents. And two, kill more college-age students.
Oh, man.
The database will include students' birth dates, social security numbers, ethnicities, grade point averages, fields of study, email addresses, and every sad thing Mark Maron ever wrote in the John Stewart chat room under the pseudonym Candy Girl.
Wait a minute.
Shameful.
Do I need that?
Ignominious.
All right.
Mark.
What?
The information in these files will enable the government to ruthlessly study and select our children for sleazy exploitation faster than a micro camera hidden in one of Michael Jackson's llamas. Soon, heartless recruiters will be roaming our neighborhoods like salesmen, searching for victims, and armed with so much sensitive personal information, it'll make the Scientologists look like Amway.
Recruiters? Door-to-door recruiters?
That's right, Mark. Ever meet a fella by the name of Rumsfeld?
What's the fella's line?
Never worries about his line.
Never worries about his line?
Or a doggone thing. He's just a bang-beat, bell-ringing, big hall, great-go-necker-nothing, rip-roaring every time a bullseye salesman. That's Secretary Rumsfeld, Rumsfeld, Rumsfeld. He's an Army man.
He's a what? He's a what?
And he sells war to the kids in town with the big brass bombs and the rat-a-tat guns and the piccolo with uniform suit with the shiny gold braid on the coat with a big red stripe running down.
But he doesn't know the territory.
Or doggone thing. It's just a bang-beat, bell-ringing, big hall, great-go-necker-nothing, rip-roaring every time a bullseye salesman. That's Secretary Rumsfeld, Rumsfeld, Rumsfeld. He's an Army man.
He doesn't know the territory.
You can talk, you can talk, you can bicker, you can talk, you can bicker, 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 you can talk, 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 bicker, 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 you can talk all you want.
All right, Mort, I'm through with this now.
Look, what do you talk? What do you talk? What do you talk? What do you talk? You can talk. You can bicker. You can talk. You can talk.
Mort, shut up. Shut up. Just shut up already.
Mark, Rummy's failed attempt at running a war doesn't give him the right to decimate the next generation of bad poets and philosophy majors any more than your failed career in musical theater gives you the right to yell at me for being a sensitive artist. Remember that the next time Marky Jr. comes back from the home ec class and tells you you hate his freedom. And that's today's dispatch from the War on Brains.
Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah, did yourself today.
Shipoopy, shipoopy. The girl who's hard to get.
I was worried at the beginning because you're starting to get tangled up, and I thought, we're never going to get through this. But,
you know how it is.
You pulled it up.
It's like 3 in the morning, isn't it? I haven't slept.
It's something like, you haven't slept. What were you up doing?
Writing this crap. Searching all over the internet for the Music Man. What do you think I'm doing?
Did the burger fumes get to you? Are you okay?
Yeah, the pink patty has a face on it still.
Kayla was eating a breakfast cheeseburger, and apparently it's very raw in size, but, you know, it's nice, and there's nothing to worry about, according to the USDA spokesman.
This didn't come from the twitching cow.
No, I would hope not. It tastes good. It doesn't taste mad cowy, does it?
No. Yeah, it's great. It does. Champions.
Yeah, yeah. And what do you got? What are you eating there with it, Kalo?
Some fries with ketchup.
That's good. That's good at 7 in the morning.
It's delicious.
It's almost like, what, are your parents out of town?
They are.
It's a hamburger. It's like one of those things. It's like, you know what? I'm going to do whatever I want. I'm having cake. No dinner.
I should digest in about 10 years. Don't worry about that.
Oh, good.
So now, that's right, we do the vegetarian thing with you, man. So what do you eat for breakfast as a vegetarian guy? I mean, do you know how to cheese?
Yeah.
Do you find that it backs you up a little bit? I'm just curious.
Yeah, that's where the psyllium husk comes in.
Oh, so you cheese and psyllium husks. So you actually have to count.
Psyllium husks?
That's right.
You ever, you know what that is, right?
It's solely
I know
fire.
What psilocybin is.
Well, no. It's a completely different effect. Right?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah, wrong pee.
Wrong decade, Captain Trips.
Hey. Watch your mouth, all right? The colors.
Psyllium husks. No, this could be pretty much one color with the husks.
Gray?
No, I would hope not. Psyllium husks is a laxative, Mark.
Ooh!
It's a naturally occurring laxative from the husks of psyllium. It's what the Metamucil is made out of, I believe.
Cliff bars.
Really?
Cliff bars.
Does that have psyllium husk in it?
Oh, I use it to clear myself out and clean the sink.
How about an AutoZone? We got an AutoZone?
Get into the zone! AutoZone!
Right. Nice. Can I see your driver's license and registration?
Oh, Jim.
California.
You're doing great work here.
Yes.
You know, you really are. And we really appreciate you coming down.
Yeah, see you in court.
Yeah. Wait, that's the other guy's.
Sorry.
It's all right. AutoZone!
What the hell was that?
I'm sorry, man. I was trying to...
You know, just stay in your own area.
Remember your place.
All right, well, you can get out of it now. Could you get out of my area?
Yeah.
We've got things to do.
Time for a nap.
All right. It's been a hard day.
Bye!
Yeah, maybe you can churn out two jokes by the end of the day, if that'd be all right for tomorrow. Thanks, buddy. I'll talk to you later.
Ooh, he's coming up,
oh, come on! Coming up, we got comedian Robert Klein, and we're also we're going to talk more about the speech that the president, I guess is what you call him.
Was that who he was?
He's posing as the president.
Oh, my God. All coming up next on Air America Radio.
You're listening to the best of Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.